It's 6 o'clock, and you're listening to KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. Welcome to KDNK's weekly newsreel,
a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. The weekly newsreel is underwritten by RJ Paddywax Pet Outfitters, next to City Market in Elgebel. Open 7 days a week. More info at 970-963-1700 or rjpaddywax.com.
I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. Opening day for Independence Pass is supposed to be May 21st this year. The Colorado Department of Transportation is on track to meet that date, but Pitkin and Lake County officials and other agencies will have the final say, reports the Aspen Times. Right now, lodging on both sides of the pass is shut down, and both counties have issued orders for second homeowners and visitors to stay away. Governor Jared Polis has advised Coloradans not to travel more than 10 miles to recreation areas. In a statement issued Thursday, the Colorado Department of Agriculture says that the state is a top beef cattle producer in the nation and has millions of pounds of meat in cold storage. Commissioner of Agriculture Kate Greenberg said that empty shelves in grocery stores do not represent a food shortage, but are a result of the challenges of keeping up with inventory stocks due to increased sales. She also said that temporary closures of meatpacking plants does not mean that there will be beef shortages or significant price hikes. A recent survey conducted by Fishbowl, a workplace social network, shows that over 80% of workers across the U.S. would not feel safe going back to work if their state reopened now. Other recent Fishbowl surveys show 54% of U.S. workers fear layoffs as a result of the pandemic, 42% drink alcohol while working from home, and less than half of students are showing up for remote classes. Garfield County libraries plan to reopen Monday, May 11th. According to a press release, library hours will be limited. Public computers will not be available. All libraries will enforce strict social distancing, which means patrons must wear a mask that covers the nose and mouth to enter any of the branch buildings. More information and library hours are at gcpld.org. Freeport Mac Moran, owner of the Climax Molybdenum Mine in Lake County, is revising operations due to COVID-19 impacts on the global economy. Leadville Today reports that employee hours and production levels will be cut in half for the remainder of 2020. Earlier this month, the company suspended operations at its Chino copper mine in New Mexico due to a COVID-19 spread among employees. Greater sage-grouse numbers are expected to continue a four-year decline across the West, reports the Wyoming-based Powell Tribune. State-level data show that sage-grouse populations have declined 44% on average since 2015, despite a collaborative conservation plan signed that same year. In an April letter to the White House, scientists accused the Interior Department of ignoring current science. The watchdog group Center for Western Priorities reports that 27% of oil and gas leases sold under the Trump administration are in sage-grouse priority management areas. COVID-19 cases are still on the rise in Colorado. As of April 30th, there were 15,768 confirmed cases statewide, up from 12,256 cases last week. Deaths from COVID-19 across the state increased by 146 people to a total of 820. 75,259 people have been tested, an increase of a little over 18,400 last week. According to the State Health Department, cases peaked on April 25th. In Garfield County, confirmed cases increased by 12 to bring the total to 93. Eagle County saw an increase of 38 confirmed cases. Mesa County confirmed cases jumped by 10. Rio Blanco County continues to report only one case of COVID-19. As of May 1st, Pitkin County reported 50 positive test results. Aspen is now under a mandatory mask law in public businesses, on transit, and wherever you cannot maintain 6 feet of social distance. More information is at cityofaspen.com. Colorado is no longer under a statewide stay-at-home order, but Governor Jared Polis warns he might have to bring back restrictions if there's a fresh spike in coronavirus cases.
Polis says he hopes he can continue to lift restrictions and allow restaurants to open soon. But he says if people, quote, slack off and stop wearing masks in public, that may not happen.
We're going to be watching the data every single day. And if the numbers begin to climb at an unsustainable rate, then we're likely to have to go backwards rather than forward.
He says residents should continue practicing social distancing during the so-called safer at home period. Meanwhile, retail stores will be allowed to reopen Friday if they take precautions like requiring employees to wear masks. I'm Scott Franz in Denver.
Local businesses are navigating state and county guidelines for reopening Monday, May 4th. KDNK's Lucas Turner spoke with Carbondale Mayor Dan Richardson and Carbondale Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Andrea Stewart to find out more about how this affects the town of Carbondale, local businesses, and daily life.
Let's just start with you, Dan. I was hoping that you could start us off by giving sort of your explanation and view on what safer at home means and what we're really supposed to be taking away from that phrase, safer at home.
Obviously, that phrase comes from the governor, and the idea is to differentiate it from stay at home, which was a mandate, thou shalt stay at home. And now he's saying you're still better off to stay at home and you're safer at home than you are to venture out. And so I think the idea is we're going to start relaxing some of the requirements of the public orders, such as some businesses are going to be allowed to open, you're not required to stay at home, but we still need to maintain all those precautions, social distancing, the hygiene, the stay at home for vulnerable populations. So I think the idea is to warn people that, yes, some things are opening up, but for the most part, we need to maintain that the strict guidance to the other aspects of the stay at home order.
Okay. So obviously, the town itself actually has facilities and other locations that get managed. I was wondering if you could talk about how the town is handling that. Talk about what's opening and what is remaining closed.
Sure. Well, it's a pretty easy question to answer because really there's no changes to town facilities. Everything that was closed prior to the safer at home order is still closed. The reason that is for different reasons. Our rec center, we decided that we're not going to open the rec center until we're allowed to have more than 10 people gathering because you just can't really operate the rec center otherwise. Some of the other facilities like the playgrounds and the tennis courts, we're looking for guidance on how those specific activities can be kept safe while allowing people to use them. And so until we have that guidance, we've looked to the U.S. Tennis Association and National Parks and Rec organizations for that guidance. And until we feel good that we can meet the intent of the order and keep things safe, we're going to keep everything closed. So right now, pretty much just parks and trails are open.
Town Hall, for example, are there people working in Town Hall?
We've split it up so only 50% of the employees are there at any given time. And no one from the public is allowed to go into the offices. So if the public needs to do something at Town Hall, they stay in the lobby and they can communicate via phone. So it's open, but not fully functional.
But it is an example of an office that is open as in people are in there, but there are still specific precautions that are in place in order to protect not only the people working there, but also the public and the vulnerable population. Is that right?
That's correct.
One thing that I am really curious about is the emergency task force. And I've talked to you about it in the past, and it's constantly changing and there's new initiatives. Last time I talked to you, maybe it was during the town hall, I can't remember, but you mentioned that the task force had a lot of volunteers and that they were looking for leaders. Is that still the case? And then what other needs are there or ways that people could sort of assist the task force?
I think the needs really ebb and flow depending on different initiatives and volunteers. I don't think that we're hard pressed for volunteers right now. And I do think we have all the initiatives. We have essentially a leader for all the initiatives right now. That wasn't the case a week and a half or 2 weeks ago. And right now, the need still seems to be making masks. That's one of our initiatives, is making masks. And as people come out of the woodworks and start going back to work and businesses, we're going to need more and more masks. So that's probably a big need. Donations and help with food, and those organizations that can get resources to individuals and communities right away is a high need. I'd say those are the two highest needs. I don't know, Andrea, if you have any others you'd add.
Yeah, I would agree with those. I think especially Carbondale, we rely so much on volunteers. And so it's always great when you have more volunteers than what you actually need. I feel like those that really want to do their part, what we can really ask collectively is for them to practice what you opened the interview with, of being safer at home and doing your part in that capacity and washing your hands. And, you know, if you're sick or if your health is already compromised, to stay home, to work at home if necessary, to continue to do that and just follow the state protocol.
So let's shift to you, Andrea. Can you talk to me about some of the support that the chamber is offering to businesses in Carbondale, specifically around reopening, the county safety plans, and what businesses can get from the chamber, and how they utilize those resources?
As Dan mentioned earlier, the Carbondale Chamber is serving as the lead line of effort within the economy aspect of the task force. So with that, we've been working with other entities, including CoVenture, Carbondale Arts and Creative District, and others, to really help bring this messaging to the business community. And with that, we've created a number of different resources and outlets. One is our Business for Business. That's just a quick reference guide for entities that, you know, they're looking for takeout or they want to know if a certain business is open, they can go there, and businesses can also submit their information for their business on that page as well. So that can be found on our website, carbondale.com. We've also created a Want Work, Have Work job posting board. So entities that perhaps are looking for work and those that have work can really work together to get those tasks accomplished. And now as we turn, we're definitely looking to reopen. We're following Garfield County guidelines. What we're really trying to do is just, you know, assist businesses and mentor them in such a way that we can get them ready when the dates allow for them to open. So with that, we're working with a local company, Roaring Fork Sign, to potentially offer signs to our chamber members after they've completed the roadmap here that Garfield County put out, just to also ensure employees, but to patrons as well, that they have followed the guidelines. And then we're also working with local entities, including Marble Distilling Company, to help provide hand sanitizer to the businesses. So those are two things the businesses have to have in order to open, in addition to all of the other protocol that's listed within the county's roadmap. So they do have to have hand sanitizer and then post this sign saying that they have followed county guidelines to be able to open. And what we found is it's really difficult. I was on a call earlier this week with chambers throughout the state, and a lot of our businesses are just not large enough to have corporate accounts to be able to buy hand sanitizer, masks, gloves, and bulk. And so any way that we can help those businesses, but also promote locally. I do know Marble Distilling Company is selling 2 gallon and 5 gallon hand sanitizer in bulk. So please contact them if you're interested in getting that for your specific business.
Just to wrap it up, I would be curious to hear your thoughts on this new world of social distancing. Kind of mind-boggling a lot of times, wrapping your head around it. So I guess if either of you would like to speak towards kind of the importance of social distancing, but also like how do we maintain that sort of culturally? What is important to remember or think about so that we can continue what is, I think, completely unnatural and still really hard for people to deal with, if that makes sense?
Lucas, that's a really hard question to answer. It's hard, just practically speaking, of how we're going to be able to do it, but also, as you say, to kind of wrap our arms around the fact that life as we know it is changing, at least for a while, and that human connection is going to be different moving forward. But I also think that people recognize the value in really maintaining that, that there's a lot of lives at stake. There's just health at stake. My understanding is that the distance is really key. probably the most important thing, to keep distance from other people. And so I think that's going to be something that we just have to make habit, that we just don't interact with people closer than 6 feet. And if we must, then we have a face covering of some sort. We have to get used to washing our hands pretty much every opportunity we get. And that's just going to be the new norm for a while. And it may be the norm for, you know, many years, because this may not be the only virus that hits us. I think most importantly, though, and what I'm sensing right now, is we have to come to terms with how we feel about things. I'm sensing a lot of anxiety. There are some who feel really strongly that we have to protect ourselves at all costs. And there are some that believe that we should open everything up. And it's creating some tension right now. And in some cases, we're not always acting as our best selves. And so I think really coming to terms that this is somewhat of a new normal, we have to come to terms with how we all accept it so that we can be good neighbors, because I'm worried about that as much as I am the virus right now.
You're listening to the Weekly News Reel, featuring top stories aired between Monday and Friday. In-kind support comes from Grassroots Community Network, promoting civic participation through civil discourse, creative endeavors, and cultural interaction. Grassroots TV also partners with KD&K to air live Pitkin County public health and community meetings. More info at grassrootstv.org.
Pitkin County stay-at-home order has been extended through May 8th. Pitkin County visitors and residents must continue to follow the guidance outlined in the last amended Pitkin County Public Health Order. The time frame of the extended order is consistent with other counties, including Boulder, Denver, Adams, Arapahoe, and Jefferson counties. Public health officials say it will allow the community to develop strategies and guidelines for preventing a surge of COVID-19 cases when it moves to the safer at-home phase.
If you're a little confused about the different county requirements, the town of Basalt has a chart with Eagle, Garfield, and Pitkin County rules and health orders, plus useful links at basaltchamber.org. The Aspen Community Foundation has launched an Aspen to Parachute COVID-19 resource webpage with information about food, financial assistance, childcare, volunteer opportunities, and more. KDNK's Lucas Turner spoke with Valerie Carlin, Community Investment Director at Aspen Community Foundation, to learn more.
Aspen Community Foundation created this resource page. How long has this been in development, and why was this identified as a need?
So we host twice weekly meetings with our nonprofits, schools, and government partners, and we sit and talk about the needs, the gaps, what's happening, what people are doing. And in these early conversations, and we're talking in the middle of March when we started them, it was very, very clear that a centralized resource place was lacking. And we seem to be best positioned to be able to take in the information from a variety of sources and roll it up into kind of a single entry point that anybody in the region could access. And so that's what we set out to do. We worked with Kissane Viola Designs out of Aspen. They were very gracious to donate their time to help us get this page up and running. And we made sure we had a Spanish language page as well. So we see ourselves kind of as the hub, because we are talking to a variety of different organizations around the region and even across the state on what's happening. And so we feel like we're able to pull that information together.
I just really like the layout. I like the headings that say what to do if, you know, fill in the blank. So can you speak to the methodology behind doing it that way?
It was pretty simple in that we were, as the Aspen Community Foundation staff, you know, we worked sort of together to think about what information do we need to include? What is our role as the information hub? We don't need to invent any information. We just need to gather it and put it out there. And so we started thinking about how would a person easily navigate the information? And we came about as a series of questions.
So you don't have to list them all because there's a lot, but what are some of the primary questions that are on there?
Well, it's, you know, I need food. Where do I go for food? I need economic assistance. Where do I go for economic assistance? I'm having some mental health problems. How do I get mental health services? I'm sick. What do I do if I'm sick? There's a lot of questions about that. So just pretty simple, basic stuff. But we were trying to lay it out in a way that would categorize things pretty simply. And again, around some, we thought, some basic questions people might be asking during these times.
Speaking again with Valerie Carlin, Community Investment Director at Aspen Community Foundation. Can you tell us where people go to find these resources?
The website is a2pcovid.org.
Information is updated regularly. A Spanish language page is available at a2pcovid.org/sp. Testing is considered a major requirement on the path back to normal, and as the president has made clear, it's largely up to states to find the way. Utah and New Mexico are leading the way, while other states are still lagging behind.
Testing for coronavirus is considered a major requirement on the path to getting back to normal, and the president says that responsibility belongs to the states. Are Mountain West states up to the task? Ray Ellen Bichelle reports.
Ashish Jha is the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, and he says there are strong signs that two of our states are doing a good amount of testing relative to the size of their populations and their outbreaks.
I think what Utah and New Mexico show us is that clearly this is doable. Like the people who think, oh, testing is too hard, can't do it. No, you can do it. And they've done it.
The rest of our region, though,
Colorado and others need to get their act together and move forward on this, especially as they begin to think about opening up.
But how did Utah and New Mexico manage to pull it off when other Mountain West states couldn't? Jha says some of it is probably out of a state's control, like its size.
But I don't think it's magic. I don't think it's just you got lucky.
Turns out there are at least two big differences about New Mexico and Utah that could be playing a part. Number one, testing czars. In mid-March, New Mexico and Utah did something that none of our other states did. They appointed people whose entire job is to figure out how to ramp up testing, coordinating not just with public labs, but also commercial ones. In New Mexico, Dr. Stephen Jennison plays that role.
I'm a retired physician, infectious diseases specialist.
And he has a long history of working with viruses. Now, all he thinks about is expanding New Mexico's COVID-19 testing.
About 16 hours a day. This is my job.
Jennison started by getting a lay of the testing landscape. He learned that two big healthcare systems seem to have a good handle on testing in urban areas. So Jennison and his colleagues focus their energy on rural areas. Now,
on any given day, there are between 50 and 60 testing sites.
At the same time, Utah's testing czar, Nate Checkitz, was identifying the bottlenecks keeping labs in that state from testing more. Early on, they were short on the key chemicals needed for the tests. So Checkitz says they launched a statewide search.
And we found them everywhere.
For example, he says a manufacturer found a box of 750 test kits just lying around and donated them to the state. Checkitz also set up a regular conference call with all the local laboratories.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the evening, we get together for an hour and run through these issues.
He says the labs have been trading tips, like leads on where to get supplies, even at times sharing materials. That brings us to the second thing that stands out about Utah and New Mexico, their laboratories. Most of the Mountain West has relied largely on their public health labs and two national companies, LabCorp and Quest. But Utah and New Mexico have a different setup. In those states, local commercial labs have done the lion's share of testing, doing about half of all COVID-19 tests or more. In Utah, that's ARUP Laboratories. Dr. Julio Delgado is the chief medical officer, and he says they were already prepared to some extent for viral epidemics, like Zika virus.
So we had all the instrumentation that normally is used for those type of pandemic situations. And then we were able to quickly deploy them for this type of testing.
Initially, ARUP was accepting samples from patients across the country, as they usually do. But Delgado says they quickly got swamped, so they had to make a difficult decision to stop accepting samples from so many places.
That was probably the five most difficult days of my life as a professional.
In the end, they decided to focus primarily on testing in Utah. In New Mexico, Tricor Reference Laboratories has played a similar role. Dr. Douglas Clark is the chief medical officer. He says, like ARUP, they already had a lot of diagnostic testing equipment.
We didn't have to purchase the instrumentation, bring it in, get it validated. It was already here.
Clark says it also helped that Tricor has a big footprint across the state, working with a bunch of healthcare sites, including 15 hospitals.
That really allowed us to have access to large number of patients as soon as the pandemic began here in New Mexico.
New Mexico and Utah's relative testing successes weren't flukes, at least according to their testing czars. Utah's Nate Checkett says leadership in his state prioritized it.
It's a core part of every state strategy, but we've really leaned heavily into that as trying to find a way forward through this crisis.
Stephen Jennison echoed that sentiment. He says in New Mexico, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham took testing seriously right from the beginning.
I believed that this governor was doing the right things and doing them early.
Enough so that it felt worth it to leave what he calls a fairly blissful retirement to enter the COVID fray. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Raylan Bichel.
A new report documents how the U.S. Bureau of Land Management's tilt toward extraction on public lands threatens wildlife and Western sporting traditions. The Uncompahgre Resource Management Plan in Colorado would open up 95% of the landscape there to oil and gas development. Aaron Kindle with the National Wildlife Federation says development at that scale would degrade and fragment habitat, disrupting historic migration routes and mating and birthing sites.
It really has the potential to change hunting in the area and perhaps reduce the hunting opportunity to such a degree that hunting is really not viable in the area anymore, nor are the businesses and economies that rely on hunting in the area.
Kendall notes Delta and Montrose counties saw more than 105,000 hunter days in 2017, which played a big part in the $3.5 billion outdoor recreation economy in the area. Proponents of the Trump administration's energy dominance policies say development on public lands is necessary for the nation's economic and energy security.
For KDNK, I'm Eric Galatis.
Leslie Robinson has thrown her hat in the ring to run for Garfield County Commissioner against Republican incumbent Mike Sampson. Robinson, a Democrat, is a 40-year rifle resident and chair of the Grand Valley Citizens Alliance, a nonprofit group working on oil and gas issues. She was also involved with several newspaper startups in Rifle and Glenwood Springs, served as executive director of United Way of Garfield County, and has worked in retail management. In a press release, she said she's stepping into the race because, quote, Garfield County citizens need a new choice and a new voice in county government, end quote. Mike Sampson has served for 12 years representing the county's 3rd district and is running for his 4th term. County Commission Chair John Martin, representing District 2, has served for 24 years and is running for his 7th term in November. Carbondale trustees confirmed town manager Jay Harrington's pick for police chief Tuesday. KDNK's Lucas Turner has the story.
Under Carbondale's town charter, the Board of Trustees has to confirm the job offer for police chief. On Tuesday, they did just that. Town manager Jay Harrington began by detailing his decision to offer the position to Sergeant Kirk Wilson, who currently works for the Rifle Police Department.
We went through a very extensive background checking from both kind of the HR side and the law enforcement side. Kirk passed with flying colors, and so I did offer him the position. He accepted, and then under the charter, you would be approving that appointment that I've made.
The hiring process, which vetted 4 individuals, included interviews with the community, town staff, trustees, and more. Town manager Jay Harrington says Sergeant Wilson is expected to begin in June, overlapping with current police chief Gene Schilling. Then he'll take over the role completely when Chief Schilling retires in September after nearly 4 decades of service. During Tuesday's meeting, Wilson reflected on what his approach will look like when he takes over.
I really look forward to the opportunity given to me in this specific scenario to work with Lieutenant Wordsmith and Chief Schilling to really get to know the community, figure out who I need to know within the community, start establishing relationships, and then also delve into getting good relationship and a great relationship going within the Latino population, as well as the school district.
Mayor Dan Richardson also inquired about Kirk Wilson's living situation, and Wilson responded that he was currently looking for a home in Carbondale and plans to move to town as soon as possible.
All right, we have a motion by Erica, seconded by Marty. With that, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. We have ourselves a new police chief. Welcome aboard.
Congratulations, Kirk.
Soon to be Chief Wilson.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Great greatly appreciate it.
The Weekly Newsreel is a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening and have a great week.